Good afternoon, Regent Radio listeners. This is Omay Sama Rahimtullah, and I am joined on the line with Dr. Gerald Horn. Hello, Dr. Horn.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, and you?
I'm okay.
It's getting kind of cold here in Toronto. That's the only thing going on here. So we have a lot to talk about this week. You sent me quite the list. So let's start on the continent with the elections in Mali.
Well, yes. I should mention, of course, that we're talking on Wednesday, and so therefore we may seem to be a bit behind the curve, but that's not actually the case. Now, you said the elections in Ghana, or?
Sorry, yes, I meant the elections in Ghana.
Yes. Well, I think we may have mentioned in a previous broadcast or podcast that John Mahama was the incumbent. He had succeeded to the office after the tragic death of his predecessor, John Atta Mills. And John Mahama, as I may have mentioned at that time, is also quite the writer. He's written a quite affecting memoir that I would highly recommend to the audience for those who are trying to get an idea of what it might have been like to be growing up in rural Ghana in the latter part of the 20th century. It seems that he won the election by a very narrow margin. 50.7% of the total went to him, according to the Electoral Commission. But given the fact that the election was so close, the opposition has been up in arms, and there have been some demonstrations, but nothing earth-shaking. And it does seem to appear that Ghana is still an island of stability in West Africa in a sea of turmoil. We all know about what's happened in Cote d'Ivoire, the latest news being that the spouse of the former leader, who is now under detention by the International Criminal Court, I'm speaking of Laurent Gbagbo, and his spouse, Madame Gbagbo, is now being sought to put her under detention as well, which is quite extraordinary, I must say. And I guess I should also mention that what's happening in Mali has taken a turn for the worse. We all know about that situation, but just to bring listeners up to speed, after the overthrow of Gaddafi in Libya, which required the dropping of tons of weapons in Libya, some of those weapons leaked into Mali, allowing so-called conservative religious radicals to take over northern Mali, an area larger than France. The latest news just happened in the last 24 to 48 hours when the military in the capital, Bamako, which seems reluctant to confront these religious radicals in the north, basically decided to arrest the prime minister. And this took place after, you may recall, some weeks ago when they basically administered a severe beating of the president. I shouldn't laugh because this is utterly serious. It seems that the military is reluctant to go along with the apparent decision by the Economic Community of West African States, led by Nigeria, to intervene in northern Mali in order to dislodge these conservative religious radicals. I think that the military in Bamako feels that other military forces coming into that country might tend to eclipse them, which is probably true, and their privileged and favored position would then be disrupted. And so they've taken very stern measures against the civilian leadership. And I think it's fair to say that these religious radicals will be continuing to rule northern Mali for some time to come. And according to recent press reports, their rule has become increasingly severe and draconian. I mean, I think we've mentioned on this program the particular persecution of single women with children. They seem to have quite an objection to that idea that a single woman would have children. And they also are continuing to amputate the limbs of suspected thieves, which is quite extraordinary, needless to say. So the turmoil in Mali continues, and it does not seem at the moment that there is an end in sight.
Now, are there elections, general elections, going to be held in Mali. The new prime minister said that that might, Sisi Seko saying that that might, I mean, that that is one of his priorities. What is your take on that?
Well, if these elections do take place, it's going to be difficult since he's under arrest right now. And I would really tend to doubt it because the military seems to be very comfortable with the stranglehold they have over what might be called southern Mali. They're profiting handsomely. They control the guns. And I think that basically they are comfortable with the idea of a de facto split in this country between the North and the South, where they'll rule the South and the radicals will be ruling the North. And I don't think, however, that the North Atlantic countries are going to go along with that. I should mention that there was a very intriguing report in the Washington Post some days ago that says that U.S. intelligence is going to be beefed up, but not necessarily the Central Intelligence Agency, but the Pentagon's intelligence agency, which is the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. They're going to be hiring hundreds of new agents, by the way. I hope that that employment call is met with a Bronx cheer or met with noise and objection, but given the unemployment rates in North America, that's probably doubtful. But what's curious or what's intriguing about this is that they're going to be hiring academics to basically masquerade as researchers, and they're going to hire business persons to masquerade as people seeking business deals, but they're actually going to be spies. Now, this is interesting for a number of reasons. Number one, it is going to really poison the well for those who are legitimate researchers. I won't say for those who are legitimate business persons, but certainly for those who are legitimate researchers, it's going to poison the well because automatically there's going to be a shadow of doubt cast over them. But this plan by the DIA bespeaks the increasing hysteria in the North Atlantic countries about what's happening in terms of what has been described as an Al-Qaeda takeover in northern and northwest Africa. And as a result of this hysteria, I don't think that these North Atlantic countries are going to allow northern Mali to settle in to this apparent continuing rule by these conservative religious radicals.
And moving south, in South Africa, it seems that President Jacob Zuma might have a challenger for job of president of the African National Congress.
Well, yes, the Congress takes place on December 16th. Jacob Zuma, you may recall some years ago, dislodged Thabo Mbeki as leader of the ANC and therefore as president of South Africa. Jacob Zuma, of course, is bathed in scandal. I mean, in some ways, he's in the same boat as Silvio Berlusconi of Italy. Berlusconi has to remain in parliament in order to escape prosecution because parliamentarians have prosecutorial immunity. And if Mr. Zuma is not president, there is some real question as to whether or not he could be indicted on any number of scandals. One, of course, involves supposedly taking payments from a foreign arms manufacturer, and then there is a continuing scandal about what's called in South Africa in Nkandla Gate, where his residence in KwaZulu-Natal on the eastern coast of South Africa along the Indian Ocean is being reconstructed, supposedly at state expense, and apparently improperly. I mean, I could go on in this vein, and he's been really getting a terrible press lately, but at the same time, it does not appear that he will be dislodged at this at this meeting of the ANC. His deputy, Kgalema Motlanthe, is challenging him, but it's been a tepid challenge. It has not been a full-throated challenge. And in fact, I think Mr. Motlanthe will be dislodged as a deputy in apparent retaliation by the delegates for for his having the gumption and audacity to challenge Mr. Zuma. Now, I'm sure that some of the listeners may be scratching their heads and saying, well, if Mr. Zuma is bathed in all these scandals, and as one South African analyst has described him as the worst ANC leader of all time, well, then what do the delegates see that these commentators and others do not see? And that's a complicated question. But one point that I will mention is not irrelevant, which is that Mr. Zuma is a Zulu. And there has been this notion that the ANC has been severely underrepresented in terms of Zulus and the leadership. And even though there has been all of this blather about a so-called peaceful transition from apartheid rule in 1994, the fact of the matter is that thousands of people were killed during the weeks leading up to those first democratic elections, most of whom were in KwaZulu-Natal. And a lot of it had to do with a kind of conservative Zulu leadership led by the so-called Inkatha Freedom Party, basically stirring up things. And so, in some ways, Mr. Zuma is benefiting from his ethnicity. The idea is that if he were to be removed, many Zulus would interpret that as a step backwards, a step away from their legitimate representation in the highest ranks of the country, and might go on the warpath, for example. So there you have it with regard to South Africa.
And in Egypt, a referendum vote has been called for Saturday, and this coming, of course, at the heels of a couple of weeks ago, President Morsi announcing a whole new set of powers for himself and mass protests in Egypt, in Cairo, and all around the country. What is this referendum vote going to look like on Saturday? Opposition saying that they might boycott, that they might vote no.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the latest news I heard just moments ago is that at least some of the opposition is urging a vote no on this referendum. Apparently, there will be two votes, that is to say, one on December 15th and one the following week. Part of the latest news as well is that a kind of martial law is being imposed on Egypt insofar as the military are going to be allowed to do civilian arrests. Listeners may know that militaries are supposed to fight foreign invasions or attack alleged enemies, not necessarily arrest people like they're the police, for example. There is a growing rift in Egypt, that's apparent, between what has been described as Islamists under Mr. Morsi and his Muslim Brotherhood, and those opposed to them, which includes not only secularists and so-called liberals, but also feminists and members of the Coptic Christian minority and other minorities. There's no doubt that there are some in the Muslim Brotherhood who feel that Egypt is ready to become a so-called Islamic State. As you know, part of the slogan or the motto of a dominant faction within the Muslim Brotherhood is that Islam is the answer. And they are not veering away from that particular slogan, that particular motto. And this is causing a crisis. Now, apparently, the military is sitting in the catbird seat. Obviously, they worked out some sort of deal with Mr. Morsi, as evidenced by the fact they're going to be engaging in arrest of civilians. So right now, there seems to be two forces on a collision course. That is to say, those who are Islamists and those who are not. And it's apparent as well that what had been described as an Arab Spring, if you look at Tunisia, if you look at Libya, and if you look at Egypt in particular, it's in a sense a kind of Islamist spring. And that's not even talking about the latest developments in Syria. You know about this meeting that's taking place in Morocco of scores of nations, and the United States just announced that it sees the opposition, the rebels, as the sole legitimate representative of the Syrian people, which is a blow to the al-Assad regime in Damascus. I assume that Canada will be echoing that particular point of view, not least because it's the point of view of Washington, but it's also the point of view of a number of European nations, in particular led by France. The deaths continue, 40,000 at last count. But what's curious is that at the same time that there has been this recognition of the rebels as the sole legitimate representative of the Syrian people, there has been an attempt to isolate a faction of the rebels called the Nusra Front, which the United States views as an extension of al-Qaeda. And that has not gone down very well with many of the rebels, because this alleged extension of al-Qaeda have proven themselves to be fearless fighters, that they're in many ways the tip of the spear. And it's apparent that as a result of their blood sacrifice, they're going to be playing a leading role in any post-Assad Syria that emerges. And this makes for a very curious scenario. That is to say that the United States and its allies are basically going to be supporting al-Qaeda coming to power in Damascus. Now, they're going to say that they don't, since the U.S. in particular says that it wants no dealings with the Nusra Front. It's slapping sanctions on the Nusra Front. But it seems to me that when they back this opposition, they're buying a pig and a poke. I mean, the Nusra Front is the tip of the spear, and so it's very difficult to say you're going to back the opposition, but you're not going to back the tip of the spear. And this is all very curious, but I think it basically bespeaks a kind of confusion, if you like, on the part of these North Atlantic powers, a kind of manipulation, too, in the sense that the North Atlantic powers were so eager to get rid of al-Assad, not least because of prodding from the Israelis and prodding from the Saudis, that I don't think they really thought through the consequences of their action. And I think that if they dislodge al-Assad by the end of 2012, which is their goal, there's going to be another major conflagration in Syria in 2013, this time between the rebels, then in 2013 being the government in Damascus, and their erstwhile backers in Washington, Ottawa, and Paris.
I remember maybe, I mean, this isn't too recent, but a couple of months ago, there was a lot of talk about how that kind of al-Qaeda influence is over-exaggerated as a political maneuver by the Assad regime, for example. How, I mean, is there much influence there? You seem to think so.
Well, I was just listening to Deborah Amos of National Public Radio in the United States, who has been on the Turkish border with Syria for some time, and her estimation was that the Nusra Front consists of about 6,000 to 10,000 fighters, and that's about 10% of the overall rebel military force, which is not very large. But on the other hand, as noted, they're the vanguard by most estimates. That is to say, they're the ones who are willing to step in front of a hail of bullets. They're the ones who are fearless in attacking military bases. They're the ones who are fearless in terms of going on suicide bombing missions, as they're referred to on this side of the Atlantic. So it has been said, as you note, that the Damascus regime has tried to exaggerate the extent of influence of al-Qaeda-like forces, but some of the opponents of the Damascus regime, such as Deborah Amos, for example, and such as Washington commentators, for example, have been rather frank about assessing the influence of these forces. And I should also say that if you talk to the refugees, particularly there are Armenian refugees, Aleppo, which is the manufacturing capital of Syria, has had historically a substantial percentage of Armenian Christians. They're the remnants of those who fled the genocide by Turkey approximately 100 years ago, and now they're fleeing again, and they're fleeing into Armenia itself, the former Soviet Republic. And what's interesting is that one of the reasons they're fleeing is that they fear what's going to befall the Christians, such as themselves, if these rebels come to power with the Nusra Front in the vanguard. So it's a very complicated scenario in Syria, no doubt, but I think it's fair to suggest that I don't think that it's going to be a step forward for humanity if these rebels come to power.
And moving over to, you had noted, and I'm sorry, I could not make sense of what this is, but Russia and the Northern Sea route through Canadian waters?
Well, yeah, this is something we talked about before, and I know it's of particular interest to Canadian listeners. That is to say that with climate change, the Arctic ice pack is melting, and what's happening is that a sea route that heretofore had not been available is now opening up between Europe and Asia, going through the top of the world, through waters that are contested between Canada and Russia. And before we get into the Canada-Russia conflict, which we admittedly talked about some weeks ago, I should also mention that this has implications for the Suez Canal and for Egypt, because before climate change, these ships going from Europe to Asia would go through the Suez Canal, or they go around the Cape of Good Hope at the tip of southern Africa to go from Europe to Asia, or vice versa, from Asia to Europe. But if you spin the globe and you look at the globe of planet Earth, you'll see that it's much shorter to go from Europe to Asia through this northern sea route, which it seems to me is going to become increasingly important as a transit route for trade between what is now the richest continent, Europe, and what will soon be the richest continent, which is Asia, in the 21st century. And this is going to be a major challenge for Canadian foreign policy. It's possible that, and I know many people in Toronto think that Canada is too close to U.S. foreign policy as of now. Well, if Canada comes into sharper conflict with Russia, I think that Canada, as a defensive measure, will probably become even more willing to embrace the foreign policy of Uncle Sam as a defensive measure against this challenge from Russia, because it was really Russia which has been quite aggressive in saying that this northern sea route is going through Russian waters and therefore should be promoted.
And we only have a few minutes left, about 6 minutes, but we wanted to talk about Hugo Chavez's recovery from a recent surgery related to his cancer.
Yeah, it's quite unfortunate. Mm-hmm. Within the last 24 hours, he's had a six-hour surgery with regard to this cancer that's in his pelvic area. But I guess what's even more disturbing is just before this operation, Mr. Chavez did what he had been reluctant to do heretofore, which was designate a successor. A former foreign minister, Nicolas Maduro, a current vice president, a former trade union activist, a former transit worker, and a man who gets favorable reviews from progressive forces and forces on the left. But on the other hand, it's not an exaggeration to say that it's going to be very difficult to replace Hugo Chavez. Now, of course, this former French president Charles de Gaulle once said, the cemeteries are full of indispensable people. So there's no individual who you can say is indispensable. But at the same time, if you could say that there is an indispensable figure in terms of the revolutionary process in Venezuela, it would be Hugo Chavez. He's only 58 years old. I mean, that's not that old, quite frankly, particularly when you consider that Fidel Castro is 86. But at the same time, the prognosis is not very positive for Mr. Chavez.
And the last thing we wanted to talk about is the absurdity of the Peace Prize going from Obama to the European Union.
Yeah, well, that was rather curious, wasn't it? I mean, first of all, it's sort of self-congratulation that it's the Nobel Peace Prize administered by the Scandinavian countries. Then they're giving it to the European Union. Now, of course, Norway is not part of the EU, but still, Sweden is, for example, which is part of this process. But then the Peace Prize, I mean, what about the conflict in the former Yugoslavia, which the NATO countries avidly joined in on, which involved days of bombing of Yugoslavia? It was just an article in the New York Times today about Kosovo, which have emerged from the rubble of the bombing of the former Yugoslavia, and it's talking about how the economy is being privatized, and the privatization process is basically rewarding U.S. diplomats who were the architects of the NATO policy. I'm speaking of Madeleine Albright, the former U.S. Secretary of State, General Wesley Clark, the former U.S. military commander. They basically pursued a policy as government officials that led to the breakup of Yugoslavia, and now as private citizens, they're profiteering from it. It's really quite an amazing story about how you use the government to line your own pockets, and it's a major scandal. But perhaps even more scandalous is how the European Union, this vector of war and aggression, could be given the Peace Prize. I mean, it's almost like it's a bad comedy routine. I still find it hard to believe.
It kind of makes me think, like, Obama getting it, and then the European... Like, we can't take this seriously anymore, this idea of the Peace Prize.
Well, yeah, to a degree, but then, of course, they'll try to clean it up by perhaps nominating Ome to be the Peace Prize, and then we'll all be satisfied, and we'll say, yes, that was a very wise decision, and they'll regain their credibility. And then the year after that, they'll nominate Stephen Harper, and we'll be grousing and complaining once again. I mean, that seems to be how it works.
And remind me now, was it a woman with it last year?
Let's see, last year, I can't recall who got it last
Neither
year.
Can I, because I'm thinking then they're not doing their up-and-down record as you're predicting. it just...
Well, you know, Desmond Tutu, you know, Nelson. Remember when they gave the prize simultaneously to the Vietnamese and Henry Kissinger, mm-hmm. that is to say, those who were being bombed and the bombers, or to Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk, the architect of apartheid, and those fighting apartheid. I mean, that's what I mean in terms of this back and forth. I mean, just as when we're about to turn our backs altogether on the absurdity of these peace prizes, they'll try to reclaim the territory they've lost.
Obama was 2009. I stand corrected. Last year was Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, Lima Bogwe, and Tawakol Carmen. I don't remember what happened last year, but anyways, that brings us to the end of the time we have today, and I'd like to thank you very much for joining us, and of course, thanks for reminding our listeners at the beginning that this is Wednesday, so we're not behind. It's just being broadcast a few days late. Anything else you'd like to add?
Well, no, thank you for calling, and I look forward to speaking to you again.
Great, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And this is Regent Radio, and we were just speaking to Dr. Gerald Horn, and we will have him again next week.